John Quintanilla Jr. is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where Texas is preparing to put Quintanilla to death by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, the state responsible for more than a third of all U.S. executions. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Gloria Rubeck. Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood. The execution watch for John Quintanilla Jr. begins.
And good evening. You're listening to radio station KPFT Houston, or you're receiving this via the internet by www.kpft.org or executionwatch.org. This is a very serious program. Tonight, John Quintanilla will become the 501st person to be executed on Texas death row since the Furman case. If you don't know that history, look it all up on the internet. It is in abundance. We are waiting for a call from Huntsville, and Gloria is already waiting. So, Gloria, you're on the air. Gloria.
Hello?
You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Ray. Well, we're standing down here in the pouring down rain, but John's case is still in the court, so there shouldn't be any witnesses crossing the street right at this moment, and hopefully never. His wife is inside waiting to witness along with his mom and one of his sisters.
By inside, you mean on the west side or the north side of the street dividing the administration building from the death house, right?
Correct. They're in the administration building.
Okay.
And there's not a... How interesting. The media that is out here today is from France and Sweden.
Okay.
No U.S. media apparently gives a damn that there's another execution going on. But one couple just drove up from Houston, said they'd come to the 500th, and they were so touched by everything that happened that they decided to come up for every execution. So we're just standing here getting wet, talking to the people from France and Sweden, and there's wood.
Is it raining heavily, Gloria? Is
pretty heavy, to the point I had to put the sound system under cover.
Okay.
And my hair is dripping in my face. But, I wanted to say something to the guys on the road, because I know John has a lot of friends. And originally his attorneys, and he's got good attorneys now, finally. Of course, he has good ones when they need them. But anyway, David Downs, some other attorneys are working on his case, and they were using the Trevino case, which has to do with ineffective assistance of counsel. And they told his wife, you know, John has a better Trevino case than Trevino has. So we were kind of optimistic when we left the visiting room Saturday night. Of course, his wife went back yesterday and today. But I don't understand what happened.
Okay, Gloria, I think Elizabeth's been researching this. She's on another phone right now, but the thing about it is this case has twice today gone to the Supreme Court of the United States. It was, Supreme Court poured it out earlier in the day, and then they went back to the Fifth Circuit, and then they boomeranged onto the Supreme Court after the Fifth Circuit. So this may be one of those cases where we will not know the actual outcome by the 7 o'clock end of this radio program.
That's correct. And I'm hoping David Dow has all kinds of stuff up his sleeves to try to stop this execution.
Okay. Well, we always hope that something happens that the executions do not happen.
Yes, we do. And, you know, after the 500th and this despicable ruling in the Trayvon Martin case, and I was downtown today at the demonstrations and left that to come to Huntsville. And then there's another execution Thursday.
Yeah.
This is just like a bit too much. I'm sick of it.
Von Ross is going to be executed on Thursday unless a stay happens, and Von Ross will be the interview on that show. I went up and interviewed him on behalf of the prison show. I mean, on behalf of Execution Watch. What I think I'm going to do, Gloria, is to cut you loose. If anything happens up there, please call. You know the number to call.
Right.
Immediately, so that we can get that on the air in a timely fashion.
Okay, and tell Elizabeth if she hears anything from the Supreme Court to let us know.
Well, she's on the phone now. I'm going to probably go to her in a few minutes.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
And that was Gloria Rubach. Gloria Rubach is an organizer in the anti-death penalty movement. She is associated with www.abolitionmovement.org. And it's the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement is the name of the organization, but the website is www.abolitionmovement.org. And we're going to be naming several organizations that are opposed to death penalty. You need a dance card to keep them separated. Please do that. I'm going to check with, Doyle, are you pushing buttons for me? Then let's go and talk to Dave. Dave, you're on the air.
Okay, I'm here, Ray.
Okay, and just for distinction, since I just got through identifying Gloria where she's with, Dave Atwood is with the Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and that website is www.tcadp.org. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And where are you, and is it raining?
It's not raining right now, although it looks like it could. We've moved our location. You know, we move around the city. And right now we're at the corner of Woodhead and West Alabama by St. Stephen's Episcopal Church on West Alabama.
Well, I am pleased to inform you, at least at this point, there have been no crossing of the road in Huntsville.
Okay.
So that means that appellate attorney David Dow is before the Supreme Court for the second time today. So I trust those are separate issues and requiring second thoughts in that area. How many vigilants have you there?
We've got 8 people here today, Ray, which is our typical number. You know, the number went up significantly for the 500th execution, but we're at our normal number, around, you know, usually 8 to 12 is what we have, and there are 8 of us here today. Tremendous amount of traffic comes down West Alabama at this time of day. I mean, I would literally hundreds and hundreds of cars go by. And one thing I've just noticed today is just a tremendous number of people that have given us thumbs up or tooted their horn or waved or something like that. So, like I've said probably many times before, this is an indication of how the people are changing in this city. And that's why we do this. That's why we come out here, because we want them to see that they're are people that care about this issue, and that's what we represent when we're out here on the street.
Well, Dave, please give the other vigilants our regards from Execution Watch and here at KPFT.
I will do, Ray. You have a good day.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
All righty. Bye-bye.
All right. Jim, what happened in this case?
Well, John Cantanilla, for those are not familiar.
Wait. Get a microphone on here. All right. You're on.
John Cantanilla, for those folks not familiar with Texas, was reared down in what we call the Gulf Coast area around Victoria. It's about 100 miles west of Houston. And he'd gone to prison for a series of burglaries. And when he got out, he and some more guys, namely a guy by the name of Jeffrey Big, started doing a series of robberies of game rooms. Let me explain what I mean by that. We don't have legalized gambling in Texas, but a lot of these smaller towns have these game rooms where they have 8-liners and they give what they claim fuzzy teddy bears, which are really gambling establishments.
Mm-hmm.
And so what happened, they were robbing a series of these game rooms throughout that part of the country, out through Victoria, through Port Lavaca. And what happened in this particular case, the Sunday before Thanksgiving, they went into a game room in Victoria, Texas called the Action Amusement Center. And they went in fairly late that evening. They were going to rob it. Inside the amusement center was a retired deputy sheriff from Edna, Texas, a little town outside of Victoria. He and his wife were there playing games. And three people went into the place to rob it. Quintanilla went in, Jeffrey Bibb went in, and a guy named Rodney Rodriguez. And what happened, apparently, they were wearing nylon stockings over their face and carrying long rifles rather than pistols. They were carrying big guns. And what happened, Jeffrey Bibb went back into the clerk's area to kind of chase out those people. And in the meantime, Quintanilla starts robbing the customers. And what he did, he pulled a gun on the clerk who's running around giving change for people to make change. And what happened, the deputy sheriff's wife was next to the clerk. There were two women there, and he is holding a gun on them. And the deputy sheriff stood in between the two women and grabbed the barrel of the gun, and he got shot three times in the chest. He fell to the floor and was shot again. He died from the wounds. And at that point, everybody began to run out of the place, and Quintanilla shot at a couple of people leaving the place, missed them. Ended up shooting the deputy sheriff, killing him, shot one woman in the foot, and she survived. And that was pretty much it. And what happened about 2 months later, several months later, Quintanilla was picked up on another robbery case in a case out of Calhoun County. And when he was picked up on that case and was questioned by the police, he alluded to and mentioned the Billings killings. At that point, they brought in the officers from Victoria County. They subsequently interrogated him, and he ended up confessing to the murder that occurred at that amusement center, even took the police to a canal where he had thrown in some of the evidence. And so, number one, they had eyeball identification, identified him as being the shooter, although he was wearing a mask. Plus, they had his confession, which he admitted to that murder, robbery, plus a series of other robbery murders. And that was pretty much the case on the facts.
What happened to the other principals in the robbery?
The other guy, the major running guy, a guy by the name of Bibbs, ended up getting 60 years on a murder case and 50 on a robbery. And the reason they didn't seek the death penalty in that case, because they determined that Quintanilla was the shooter in this case. And the other man did no shooting, and apparently, but he's doing a 60-year sentence on murder and a 50-year sentence on robbery.
In these kind of cases, of course, they could have charged him with a capital case,
sure,
too. I mean, as a lot of parties. What distinguishes what happens in these various counties where the prosecutors decide not to go after a capital case? Is that a money-saving deal for the county?
Usually a money-saving deal, and they're normally what they generally do, they want to get the guy that did the shooting. They're after the shooters who they usually want. Sometimes it depends on how bad a criminal background the person has got. In this case, Quintanilla did a series of burglaries. It was on parole, as a matter of fact, when he committed this crime. Plus, he apparently, from looking at the opinions, was kind of the ringleader of this group of men that were robbing gang rooms. So he was kind of apparently the ringleader, according to the evidence.
So ultimately, he was a pretty easy target.
But he was the ideal target for this case. You can call it ideal.
Sure. All right, Susan, what happened during the punishment phase? This is an interesting case from a trial standpoint, I understand.
Well, at the punishment phase, I would basically say there were three categories of the state's evidence. One was, first, the state put on evidence of other extraneous bad acts and crimes. The state put on evidence that there were five other robberies, that he apparently was involved in committing five other robberies and an attempted sixth robbery. And those robberies occurred from September 02 to January 03. And they were similar type robberies of a game room.
Does that include what he was on probation for? Is this more recent stuff?
No. He was on parole for the burglaries.
Okay.
But he and two other people, what they were doing is doing a series of robberies of game rooms. And so there were five others and an attempted six. One of the game rooms let him roll. There were employees and six patrons there of similar MO. Three guys came in with masks and did a robbery. Also, he was in the county jail. When he was in the county jail, he apparently improvised something to the effect of like a knife or a razor blade and stabbed and slashed some deputies trying to escape. So the state put on that evidence. There was evidence. The state also put on evidence of some prior convictions. The prior conviction was a burglary of a habitation in 1995 that he got 10 years on. And when he pled to on that case, apparently there were five other burglaries as well. And then they had a doctor, Dr. Kuntz, that they brought in to basically testify that he would be future dangerousness, that he would likely be a future dangerous, you know, in other words, commit future crimes of a dangerous nature in the future, which in a way was overkill probably on the part of the state, but that's what they put on.
And all this happened in Victoria, Texas, which probably doesn't deal with that many homicide cases.
I don't think they do. I mean, I don't think they really, you know, I imagine this would be, plus the person who was killed was a former deputy, retired deputy sheriff. So I imagine, and there were, these are a lot of robberies, you know, of game rooms in the area. So I imagine this was, you know, would be a big crime spree in that area. And then after that, the state rested, and it was the defense turn to put on evidence, if they were going to, at punishment. And at that point, the defense lawyers indicated that they were not going to put on any evidence, and that that decision came from their client. So at that, and then the judge apparently advised the client and let Quintanilla know that there may be benefits of his lawyer putting on mitigating evidence. The judge seemed to go to quite a bit of length, you know, great lengths to advise him of the possible value of allowing his attorneys to put on mitigating evidence. And then apparently they broke, and then before the case was submitted to the jury, the judge did the same thing again, advised Quintanilla that there may be benefits of putting on evidence on the defense side at punishment. However, Quintanilla did not want his lawyers to put on any evidence at punishment. And then also from the record, it appears that there was the judge also talked to the lawyers about this. And his defense lawyers indicated that it was an ongoing issue for 2 years, that they had discussed it at length with their client, you know, on more than one occasion, and that the clients did not want them to put on any punishment evidence. So, of course, you can't help but to wonder what his thinking or reasoning might be.
Is there, I mean, of course, since no evidence was presented, Rob, we don't have any idea if there was any mitigating evidence.
Yeah, there was, because I'd done some reading on it, and he'd been pretty much abandoned as a child, and was kind of a little street urchin, and it was not, came from a very, you know, low-income family, and didn't have any particular parental guidance, and he, like I say, he was pretty well abandoned as a kid, was pretty much on his own. And that could have been some mitigating evidence, but that was not presented.
Do you think that was convincing evidence presented?
Well, it's better than saying nothing.
It's better
it's not an option whether it's good or bad. It's an option of your choices. And they either he shut up or put on something about his tragedy, about his background, not having much of a chance as a kid.
Susan, is that to give us something to talk about later in the appellate level?
No, I happen to know the appellate lawyer. The appellate lawyer was Richard Rogers. Mm-hmm. I handled a large drug case in Houston, and Richard Rogers handled the same client's federal case out of Corpus Christi. So I had numerous conversations with Mr. Rogers.
Okay. Now, Susan, what he did, though, he was the appellate lawyer on the federal writ. He was right. Not the appellate lawyer on the state
on
direct
the
appeal.
Okay.
Nor was he the appellate lawyer on the state writ. He was only on the federal appeal.
Okay.
We have been joined by Tony Diaz, and Tony would normally be on KPFT at this hour with a very fine show, Nuestra Palabra. I think of him as a Libra Traficante guy. Tony, welcome to Execution Watch.
No, thank you so much, and I'm really glad that we can team up to fulfill this huge mission of KPFT, and we are glad that our listeners are staying tuned. And, you know, we planned long, and unfortunately, Texas is killing people on the 501st.
Tony, you're a writer, mm-hmm. and you're a creative spirit, and I think some of the most excellent examples of Pacifican activity is Wet Books Project in Tuba. And you got a new project. You picked a patron saint, Libertante. tell us about that, because it deals with courts.
On July 27th, we've taken it upon ourselves to declare it Gus Garcia Day. And if you have not heard of him,
I'm
going to let that sink in. He is the Thurgood Marshall of the Mexican-Americans. He actually was the lead lawyer for the first Mexican-American team that successfully defended a case at the Supreme Court, Hernandez versus Texas, and he made Mexican-Americans a protected class.
In that case.
Exactly.
That's a groundbreaking case, is that Hernandez. In talking about today's execution, and I've got the good fortune to tell you that the phone is not ringing. And so that means that the witnesses in Huntsville have not crossed the road. Mm. This case is still before a court, and we know which one. It's before the Supreme Court of the United States, and is there for the second time today. But we just had Jim describe John Quintanilla as an abused and abandoned child. Is that unusual among Mexican-American youth?
You know what? I think if you look at the prison system, there are folks that are at the end of this pipeline that is designed to take our folks from, they call it the cradle to prison pipeline in some, you know, in some fields of thought. But the cards are stacked against our young. All I really have to do is point to Arizona's House Bill 2811, which prohibits Mexican-American studies, because that was so successful, it had stemmed the dropout rate. 98% of the students from K through 12 at Tucson and Penn School District who were taking Mexican-American studies were graduating. It had, by the own accounts of the system that wanted to eliminate the program, they had quantified that it succeeded. And every survey, every study shows that if our young do not go to school, their chances of winding up in jail increase. And I'm sorry, but if you don't get an education in this country, there's either terrible exploitative jobs, a life of crime, or, just the simple things. I think that's why it's important for us to get books in people's houses. If you have a book, it means you've got the money to spend $30 on a book. It means you've had some sort of education to read a book. It means you've got a mother and father who might encourage you to read it. It means you've got a quiet space in the house to read it. It means you're not working 40 to 50 hours. Or if you are, you still squeeze out time to read that. And that's many of our households. So when I see a house without a book, I can see the ravages of an oppressive system. But it's hard to explain all the time.
Actually, it's not. I can see in your face passion in your work, because you're actually trying to get out there and help, whether they're abandoned, whether they have family or not. They have hope somehow in literature and in pride in their heritage, and ever how you can help conjure those things and expose it, those people. The idea of going to Arizona, where they've outlawed Mexican-American studies and selling books out of trunks of the cars, is just that. The image of that is like hand-delivering hope to one person at a time, Tony. And if John Quintanilla had experienced somebody intervening with hope, he might have thought the solution to his economic problems was not in taking a long rifle into a game store. You know how difficult it is to rob a game room with a long rifle? You've got to protect an awful lot of sheet metal there, or hard metal there. It can come at you from the side and you can't move your weapon fast enough. He was desperate.
And actually, we just have to look at two examples of the books that were banned in Arizona. You have Luis Rodriguez, who's Mi Vida Loca, Gang Days in L.A. He talks about how education turned his life around. And the other book is A Place to Stand by the renowned poet Jimmy Santiago Baca, who teaches himself how to read in solitary confinement. and turns his life around by being exposed to literature. Unfortunately, these are extraordinary examples. For every two that I can name, there's millions that we just didn't get the book to in time.
Without intervention.
Without intervention.
If you go from failing in school to a prison cell and nobody brings you that book you're talking about, when you get out, if you get out, the chances of your going right back is pretty high. Tony, I appreciate the work you do.
Thank you very much.
And I thank you for your support of The Prison Show. You put some of this into context. I'm going to do a little essay, and you can critique it if you like. Let me tell you, folks, you're listening to Execution Watch because you've got a little snap. You've found out that you need to know what's going on in the world around you, especially what is being done in your name. So whether you're in Great Britain or whether you're in France or Germany, you've tuned in Execution Watch tonight to hear a horrible experience of an almost live production of an execution, which we still hope will not happen tonight. But you're here. I'm going to empower you, deputize you, to become a missionary of hope. I'm going to ask you to think of those people in your surround that need and do not have books or do not appreciate the value of them to their own lives. You, the listening audience, can do far more to prevent future John Cantanillas than the rest of us can, because you're in those hoods. You're dealing with those issues. Sometimes it's tragic. Sometimes it's not easy to look at. But the solution is bringing hope to the abandoned and the hopeless. Fair enough?
Fair enough. And it's an honor for us to get to collaborate on this.
Thank you, Tony. Good luck. Hey, by the way, as we are broadcasting this, if you've got HD equipment or if you're on the internet, you can go to a different HD channel, HD Channel 3, and Nuestra Palabra is happening in another studio in this building.
Thank you. I'm going to get back to them. So.
Okay. Thank you, Tony.
Excuse me. Thanks.
Okay. Larry, can you step up to the microphone? I think we've covered what happened, and we've talked about evidence that was presented, and you have a particular piece of this puzzle.
Well, the whole issue of the defense not putting on any kind of mitigation evidence, any punishment evidence, is sometimes somewhat troubling. I mean, but lawyers have to, from time to time, be reminded that we serve as attorneys at law. That is, we're working for other people. And those other people have decisions that they have to make.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, though, those other people that you're working for begin to think that they're a lot smarter than you are. So you have to try to work around it as much as you can. Now, what happened in this case is Quintanilla decided that no mitigation evidence is going to be put on. So he's looking at the decision between life and death. And so it's just a matter of how do I go about getting life rather than death, or does he even want death? We really don't know what his mindset is.
Right.
But the lawyers had to take precautions. That is, the judge intervened on their behalf, which I think was good, by making a record outside the presence of the jury, advising him of the risk he's taking twice, and also having the lawyers go on the record and talk about the fact that
to protect their own ass.
Because the whole issue of ineffective assistance of counsel is oftentimes raised, and so if they agree with that, that probably would have been considered to be ineffective. So in those kinds of cases, you do what you can to try to persuade the person to allow you to do your job. Because again, you work for them, but they do have some control over how you do your job. In this case, This critical area of the trial, the client made the decision, don't put on any mitigating evidence. That is evidence that I believe as a lawyer, that the lawyer believes might be used to save his life. in addition to what they did here, you know, sometimes when clients do things like that, you try to get to them by maybe going to a relative or a friend of theirs, somebody that they trust. And the one of the first people that I like to go to is really to the judge, because as they did the judge in this case, oftentimes they won't listen to you, but they might listen to the judge. Not listening to the judge, not listening to you, maybe a loved one or a friend who they listen to, oftentimes that can persuade them. But all you can do is what you can do.
The judge was trying to be as helpful to the defense lawyers as she could in this case.
And in this case, helpful and also clearly advising the client, so that the client makes it's clear that the client is making this decision knowingly and voluntarily, that nobody's forcing them to do that, and that they understand. Once you apprise the client of what the risks are, that you've got lawyers here who have some background and skill in producing the kind of evidence, just as you guys were talking about just a few minutes ago about the upbringing of the sure. of the defendant, those kinds of things could be used to cause a jury to spare a person's life. But this defendant, Mr. Quintanilla, for whatever reason, decided that this is something I don't want to do. Now, we don't know why he did that, but oftentimes it's motivated by the client's thought that I understand this better than my lawyer does.
So you don't think that it's necessarily a mental problem, and you don't have any reason to believe he was actually volunteering to be executed at that point?
We don't know, but in terms of mental problems, that was one thing that the lawyer did get on the record, is advising the judge that from having dealt with him for 2 years,
yeah,
and this was an issue that they faced in defending him for 2 years, that the lawyers were of the opinion from having worked with him that he was not incompetent. That is, that he was able to communicate with the lawyers in terms of intelligently understanding what the proceedings were all about, and being able to assist his lawyers in providing for his defense. He was able to communicate with them. It's just that this decision was a decision that he made, and he made it knowingly and voluntarily.
And a record was made of his making that decision.
The record was made of his having made that decision, made twice. A record first when the state rested on the punishment evidence after having just had an expert testify that he is a future danger, that if he is given life rather than death, he is going to cause, he's going to be danger to society, and he's even been...
Well, that's a burden of proof that the state has to make anyway. So they made that burden of proof with a professional. They brought in a psychiatrist or a psychologist, somebody to testify to that effect.
By entering a hypothetical, pretty much saying that a person who did all of these things that you've just found him guilty of doing, you found him guilty and all of the things that you just heard at punishment, that if a person does those kinds of things, stabbing a guard and in a jail yeah. break attempt, then if you let him live, he's going to continue to do the same kind of thing. So that was it's a state's burden, but it had been fairly persuasively made already. And for whatever reason, Mr. Quintanilla said, I don't want to put on any evidence at all. Why he did it, I don't know. My experience is that when you have difficulties like this, it's ordinarily brought on by the client thinking that they understand the system better than the lawyer does. That's been my experience.
It apparently went on over a period of 2 years, though the lawyers had been talking to him over a period of 2 years about putting evidence on at punishment. So they had, I guess, numerous conversations about it, and he didn't want to do that.
All right. Telephone is flashing. Will somebody see if that is Gloria? And I'll see what we can find out here. And now, there was a confession in this case, and there was some confusion about the confession, because later Quintanilla denied making, or did, said he made the confession because the police were threatening his kid's sister. So well, it was kind of a chivalry denial.
The big issue on appeal, what's been now pending for the Supreme Court, is admissibility of the confession. That's where the big flap is currently in the Supreme Court now, is admission of the confession. I think Mike's going to discuss that.
Well, what we have in this case are two issues. We have Fifth Amendment right for an attorney and Sixth Amendment right to have an attorney. And let me rephrase you. We have Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and Sixth Amendment right to have an attorney. The problem with this case is we have two code provisions that talk about these things. One is 3822, the warnings a police officer gives you when they stop you and talk to you. The second is 1517, the orders the magistrate gives you after you've been charged with a crime. So in your normal course of affairs, a policeman stops you, a policeman wants to talk to you, a policeman gives you Miranda warnings, and then you converse with him. Then they charge you and take you to court, then you get warnings to get an attorney. In this case, what they did, and understand, this man was an 8th grade education, he wasn't educated, I'm sure he didn't understand the difference between these two different rights. They did not give him Miranda warnings. They already had an arrest warrant, so they took him to court and they had gave him the right to counsel warning, 1517. The trouble with it, when he went before the judge specifically said to him, you've got the right to retain counsel, you've got the right to remain silent, and the right to have an attorney present during any interview with the police officers or attorneys. They tell him that. Then they take him out and talk to him for 4 hours. The court has said that the right to counsel is not the same as the right to Miranda. If he was Mirandaized first under 3822, then they could not talk to him. He could then open up the conversations and want to talk to them. But in this case, by not giving him Miranda, by just taking him for the 1517 warnings, he got the same words, but yet they can continue to talk to him. The fact that it took 4 hours for him to give a confession, that they had to take a break between at the two-hour mark because the interview was going so long, shows me that he was under a lot of stress. There's an old saying in this business, and it says that the mind that sends a message isn't always the mind that receives a message. What I don't understand is how the same words, one from a police officer, one from a judge, is supposed to mean different things to this man.
Now, if it had been from a police officer, then they couldn't talk to him.
They could only talk
to
him.
If he asked for a lawyer.
If he asked for a lawyer, if he just wanted to remain silent, they could not talk to them again unless he said, I want to talk to you. He has to open up the conversation. But when the warnings comes from the magistrate, that doesn't apply. They can continue to talk to him because the magistrate warning has got to do with the right to have a counsel for that charge. That specific charge you're charged with in that court, he is a lawyer for that case.
And he was arrested really on another case.
He was arrested on one robbery. It's not clear if they knew about the other case, but during talking to him, they realized there might have been another case. After the 1517 warnings and talking to him, they brought in police officers from another county to interview him about the first murder. And that's when he gave the confession. And again, he was in open court in front of a judge. He said he wanted a lawyer, but the case law is pretty clear. That lawyer was case specific for that court, a lawyer in that court to help him with that case. That does not give him the right to have a lawyer present at other questionings. I think it's confusing. I think to a person with 8th grade education is very confusing because the exact same words.
It's confusing, and I've got some college credits
it's
to my name.
The exact same words.
Let me kind of clarify that and put it in context. What had happened about 2 months after the Billings killing, he's arrested on a robbery case out of Calhoun County.
Okay.
So whenever he's arrested, they have to take him in front of a magistrate and warn him. So they take him in front of a magistrate, and the magistrate gives him a warning on the Calhoun robbery case. That's called the Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
Okay.
And so he requested at that point a lawyer to be appointed to represent him on his Calhoun robbery. That does not mean he invoked his Fifth Amendment right not to talk to the police. All it means is he has a lawyer appointed to represent him on the Calhoun County case.
None of that has anything to do with other cases.
And that does not mean the police they questioned him about the Calhoun robbery. All that stuff was suppressed because they had a lawyer representing him. But they could talk to him about other offenses, and that's what they did. And that's when he admitted a whole series of offenses, plus he alluded to the Billings murder. And they say that is admissible because when he asked for a lawyer to represent him on the Calhoun County case, that did not be was not tantamount to saying, I want a lawyer to I'm not going to talk to you about anything. I want a lawyer to represent me in all my cases. Didn't say that. So what they're basically saying is when you get a lawyer appointed to represent you on a specific case, namely the Calhoun County case, that does not mean the police can't talk to you about other offenses. They can talk to you about anything other than the Calhoun County case.
Even that the words from the magistrate is the same as the word from the police office.
Yeah.
I understand.
Mercy. So maybe we should create an orientation. If you're going into a life of crime, we got an orientation program.
You need to be
so that you can sort out these minute details.
Well, you need to read books, Ray.
Right. Reading books. Tony's right. Reading books. But I don't know that I've seen that in a book. I mean, we've been doing this show for some 5 or 6 years, and I don't think we've ever split this particular hair this fine.
Because there's a big distinction between the Sixth Amendment right to counsel and the Fifth Amendment right to counsel. Sixth Amendment is automatic when you're charged with a crime. You're entitled to a lawyer. And you don't have to do anything. They're going to appoint you one. On the Fifth Amendment, you got to ask for it to be invoked. You cannot. It's not automatic. You've got to ask for it. He never asked for a Fifth Amendment right to lawyer.
Yeah, I've got a cap at home that I got from some lawyer association with a VI on it, Sixth Amendment right. Cap that applies.
But they before police interview him, they read him his Miranda rights, okay, at the start of it. They read it to him. And he indicates he understands it, and he chooses to proceed and talk to him.
Is that after the magistrate has...
Right, it's after the magistrate
right.
Warning.
He's brought into court in front of the magistrate. He's read his rights, which he has the right to counsel on a felony case. Mm-hmm. He invokes his right to counsel.
Okay.
So I'm sure they appointed him counsel, okay? Then, after that... police come, law enforcement comes to interview him and talk to him because they're obviously investigating a series of crimes.
Mm-hmm.
They read him his Miranda rights again. His Miranda rights, in his Miranda rights, it says not only does he have the right to counsel, but he can decline the interview and not talk. He could have at that point said, I choose not to talk to any police.
And get out of here.
All he had to do is say, I have nothing to say. I choose to remain silent.
We've been talking to, of course, Jim Skelton and Mike Gillespie and Susan Ashley here. And Larry Douglas has given us a report on the interesting things that happened actually in the courtroom. But we also have Jack Lee in here, and Jack Lee has got a piece of this puzzle. You might not be realizing it, but the Execution Watch show requires the good services and hard work of 5 attorneys, and Jack Lee is... Jack, what's your piece of this puzzle?
Well, when I...
When you hit the microphone, yeah?
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the forensic psychiatrist that they had...
Okay.
That state had...
You're talking about
up.
This person's sanity at this point.
Mm-hmm. The question whether or not a defendant is... Given the death penalty or not, largely lies in whether or not he's considered a future danger. Whether the jury decides that he's going to pose a future danger, and the state in this case had called a forensic psychiatrist by the name of Richard Coons from Austin. And Richard Coons, what his job was simply to be an expert to testify that, yes, Quintanilla was going to pose as a future danger, and it's real funny the way they do that is you're not actually supposed to point to the defendant and say, yeah, given the facts, yes, that is in fact he is going to pose a future danger. It has to be phrased in a hypothetical. So what they do, I think it's disingenuous, but what they do is they take all the facts that the jury has heard, and they say, hypothetically, if this person had done these crimes, had done this, and had this kind of a background, would he pose a future danger? Well, I mean, why don't you just, rather than anonymous, just put his name down, and it's the same thing. Yeah, it's the line of questioning is seems to be silly to me. I mean, it's disingenuous. But furthermore, with Coons, he was actually Coons was asked. Coons has an interesting background. He's done over, I want to say, about 6,000 or 8,000 mm-hmm. competency evaluate, mm-hmm. 6,000 to 8,000 competency, by his own admission, competency evaluations. Mm-hmm. He's done about 100, and he's consulted on 130 capital crimes, and I believe he has testified in in 50 or 60. There was this one case in particular where that kind of gave him a black eye, and he's effectively not been used by prosecutors as a result of this. It's a case having to do with Billy Wayne Cobble. And in Billy Wayne Cobble's case, they laid out, he was asked a bunch of questions by the defense. When they cross-examined him, they asked him things like, so do you know if this, do you have a methodology that's, is there a standardized methodology in determining who is going to be a future danger? Mm-hmm. He says, no. Oh, so you're speculating? No, we're not speculating. This is more than just a hunch. So the defense also asked him, do you have any evidence, are there any books or are there any articles about whether future danger can be predicted? He said there wasn't. He was also asked if, have you looked at your testimonies, your predictions, have you determined whether or not your predictions are accurate? And he said, no, it hasn't. The funny thing is, effectively, you have an expert witness who doesn't know how accurate he could possibly be. But mm-hmm. take his word for it, he's accurate. It's a real bad situation to be in. And this actually...
Well, some of these guys wind up going to the other side from the evil empire to the force for good and testifying for defense. And then the prosecution don't want to have anything to do with them anymore.
Sure.
And then some of these guys say that future dangerous means you're black or you're Hispanic.
Right.
And they get kicked out of it. They have a vending machine where you can just get one of these throw down guys as you need them.
I believe the vending machine is very expensive.
It's called the Grigson vending machine.
The Grigson vending. Grigson's the one that got into trouble.
It's funny.
This guy's a protege of Grigson, by the way.
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's result driven. In other words, you're hiring somebody to basically testify that you're there, shall we say, in the capacity of a psychiatrist to predict that they are going to be a danger in the future. Or you may be hired by the defense to predict the opposite.
Well, it's like an environmentalist trial. You can hire somebody to tell you the end of the world is going to happen because of fracking within 30 days or less. And then you hire somebody else to say, well, you can frack the whole world and we will live forever and ever and ever. It depends on who is signing the check, right?
There's probably a lot more science behind what you're suggesting.
Oh, okay.
Wait a minute. I think you really probably do have more science. At least to play with on that.
You know,
whereas in psychiatric...
Well,
I think
wait a minute. You guys are in the practice of practicing law. Well, some of you are. You're out there and you have to face these throw-down witnesses that the state put in front of your client's trials on a regular basis. And I can tell from the expressions on your face and the tone of your voice, you think this is BS.
Well, it's not just us thinking it's BS. Justice Keller in the Cobble case actually wrote, and I'm quoting here, the court faults Dr. Coons for failing to, quote, to cite, quote, books, articles, journals, or even other forensic psychiatrists who practice in this area to substantiate his methodology while acknowledging that Dr. Coons is, quote, a genuine forensic psychiatrist with a lengthy medical career, unquote. But appellant did not introduce any books, articles, journals, or even any other forensic psychiatrist to testify that contrary to Dr. Coons' testimony, Dr. Coons' experience-based method of evaluating future dangerousness is inappropriate.
So Sharon says there ain't nothing here, but we're going to take it, right?
Well, effectively, I thought...
By the way, this is real. We close at 5, Sharon Keller, right?
Yeah. I thought this was real interesting because effectively what Justice Keller was saying was, well, defense didn't actually come up with any evidence saying that Dr. Coons is... methodology is inappropriate. So the court believe that it's inappropriate, that it doesn't work, but really the defense should have done that. Well, that's an inaccurate application of the law.
Because your presumption of innocence.
Well, not more basic than that. If you produce the witness, you're the one who has to, authenticate him to say that prove up that he's a witness.
Yeah.
That, or rather, that he's an expert.
So the burden still is with the state, and the state did not meet its burden because they put somebody on to the defense challenge successfully, right?
Well, yes. In this case, it was if the defense had put Dr. Coons up as a witness, the defense would have to explain why he is an expert.
The host needs a little time here. I need to advise the audience that it is now 6:50. The witnesses have not crossed the road. They have not crossed 12th Street from the administration building to the walls in which contains the death chamber. That means that this prosecution is not currently ongoing. This execution is not happening right now. Our fine producer Elizabeth has talked to Gloria in Huntsville, and they're in the rain. They're sitting out there. No witnesses are crossing the road. So whatever is going on at the Supreme Court of the United States is taking longer than it has taken before. Two things can happen. Either the Supreme Court can throw this case out for the second time in the last 24 hours, or the Supreme Court can issue a stay. And the window of time they have to do that is supposed to be from 6 o'clock p.m. until midnight. However, Texas prison system imposes its own limitation, and they say, don't call us after 10 o'clock to do an execution. We simply do not have time to set up for one. So the window is actually between 6 o'clock p.m., which is almost an hour ago, and 10 o'clock p.m. If the thing goes on beyond that time, and the Supreme Court supposedly never closes in these matters that can go on into the night, if it has not begun by 10 o'clock, then Mr. Quintanilla will get an operational stay. That may be a delay, or it may be a stay. If it is a stay, it has to go back to the district court and have a hearing, set a new date. If it is a delay, then operationally they can set it for another time, but not day after tomorrow night, because day after tomorrow night is another scheduled execution, and I don't think we've done two of these in a given night. And so the deal is that we're in limbo. Limbo right now. Limbo, that's somebody else altogether. But here we are in the studios of KPFT in Houston. Execution Watch is brought to you every time an execution is done. If we get a stay before the show, we cancel the show, we have no show. In this case, we did not get a stay before the show, but we got a delay. And so here we are at nearly the end of the hour without knowing. One thing you can do is you can get up in the morning, check the internet. There's a reporter that will go to the execution if nobody else will. And that's John Grazik. He writes for the AP. And his report will be in the paper. Gloria is, I trust, in Huntsville for the duration. And so she may know something, and we'll try to get her to report to whoever the programmer is here on KPFT after this show continues. Execution Watch is not a pleasant show for me to do. It is not a pleasant show for all of us, but you can tell by listening to the material that we present on this show that people go to a great deal of earnest intent to give you the information that you need to absorb what is actually happening here. Execution Watch is literally the closest thing to having to witness the actual killing of citizens in a society that does that regularly. It's a real-time What's going on is an execution in a room strapped to a gurney right now is John Quintanilla. He does not have needles in his arm pending some decision from the Supreme Court at this late hour. When that decision is handed down, needles will be placed in his arm and the chemicals prepared. The witnesses will cross the road, take their stations around the execution chamber, and observe him being killed by the state of Texas. The whole process takes a little over 30 minutes now because of the change of the drugs that they use. But it is an ugly process. It is not a pleasant thing to do. We do the execution watch because of the good work of Elizabeth Stein, who is our producer. She works hard to get this together, but no harder than Jim Skelton works in putting together a complete analysis of the case, which he shares with other lawyers and makes assignments so that they have parts of the role of presenting this to you. Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee are in the studio every time we do this. They're not getting paid for this. They care about this because they have been practicing law for a long time. I'm in this because I'm an ex-convict. I did the prison show for 33 years, and I'm still concerned with the minutiae of the criminal justice system. Gloria Rubeck is an old activist friend. We've been working together for a good many years across the broad. We've been in more picket lines than most folks have been in lines. And Gloria is up there in the rain in Huntsville, Texas, covering her. Dave Atwood is almost a saint. His activities in abolition of executions is phenomenal work. He's the former chair and one of the founders of the Houston Peace and Justice Center. That's the team. We have Doyle, who's in the other room. There he is, Doyle, smiling and waving. He does our board engineering tonight, assisted by Mike. Mike is active at keeping us online, and he keeps our archive. Otis McClay does our web work and handles that particular magic. The music we play is from Victoria Panetti. And you can find out more about Victoria Panetti through her MySpace page. That is MySpace.com/SheMonster. My name is Ray Hill, and I don't like doing this work, but we will be back Thursday for the execution of Vaughn Ross. The interview on Mr. Ross's Execution Watch show will be Mr. Ross himself. Thank you. Good night. I hope there's no execution tonight.